My name is Bob Darrow, and I am alcoholic. I want to thank Dylan and April and members of the committee for asking me to participate. It's a privilege. I really, truly try to think of this as just another thing in AA and get away from the idea that there's any kind of hierarchy here, like this is better than making coffee or cleaning the bathrooms. It's all service, you know. And if you don't think that's true, you should have been with me sleeping on the floor of the Dallas airport the last couple of weeks. I would have rather been cleaning the bathrooms in my home group. I have a sobriety date, and it's a date from which I've been free from alcohol and all other chemical treatments for this disease, and that's October 31st, 1978. I have a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor by my actions, and that's very important because if your sponsor's not sure they're your sponsor, maybe they're not. My sponsor's on my mind a lot. My sponsor, his light is dimming, and I don't know what's the predominant emotion here, if it's fear or sadness, I don't know. But I got kind of both of them going on. And it's he has been a source of direction in my life that I am absolutely convinced God works through him. He's had this ability. He can smell a rationalization on the other end of the phone. I mean, oh my God, he's amazing. Like, the minute I start to explain myself, oh, geez. And he taught me to get to the point and to report the facts. And he's very concerned with what I'm doing. And he's very concerned with the practice of the traditions in my life and what kind of an AA member I am. And he's pushed me to be the best version of me than I could ever imagine I could be. And I get scared when I think his life. I don't know. I just get scared when I think of him passing, you know, because it's not even him so much as the ethic he represents of service and of giving to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I also have a home group, and if you were to go to that group, the members of that group know that I'm a member of that group because I got jobs there. I got commitments there, and I love my home group, and I think you should love your home group. If it's inescapable not to fall in love with anything you serve, and not to stay in love with anything you serve. And I serve my home group. I'm honored to have commitments there, several a week, and I love that. It tethers me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I never have to question and wonder if I'm a member of AA. I never have to wonder, and I love that. And I have a relationship with God. I know what it looks like on my end. I wonder what it looks like to him. You know, no, I mean, because I'm sure there's Bob, and there's Bob. I mean, it must be like, you know what I mean? Like, because it kind of comes and goes, and sometimes I'm very connected, and sometimes not so much. But I never stopped taking the actions. I never stopped praying. I turn my consciousness towards him every day. And I try to imagine what his will is for me, and I try to seek and do that. And I know it has very little to do with me and a lot to do with love and a lot to do with helping his kids and being a kinder and a nicer version of me. I seek that. Not good at it all the time, but I seek it. I'm tasked with a daunting thing to share on how it works. Well, my God, that's a big piece of the puzzle here. And yet, it is probably, you know, I was just thinking about, I read how a description that Wilson talked about how he wrote Chapter 5. And it is really evidentiary of divine intervention. He said in one of his things that he had developed some kind of writer's block or something like that, and he was stuck, and he prayed and meditated, and he said that all of a sudden the pen floated across the page like it had a life of its own. It's almost a description of automatic writing. And I tell you something, Bill wrote stuff in chapter 5 that was, I am absolutely convinced, was beyond his experience. Stuff that he wrote at 3 years sober that at 30, 40 years sober, I'm going, oh. You know, it's like, right? And this stuff changes. My first sponsor used to say that the General Service Office sent out elves in the middle of the night to change the book, you know, because it moves with you. It's organic and it moves with you. And I've never seen anything. There's other books that are I'm sure that are inspired, but boy, this is particularly inspirational to a guy that has what I have. And so, you know, there's a synopsis of what we're going to do here in the beginning of chapter 5, and sort of the cliff note, the outlines of the steps, and then it starts really getting into specific directions on steps 3 and 4. And we stood at the turning point, and I think that's really step 3. We ask his protection and care with complete abandon. Ooh, complete. That's a lot. I mean, complete. I mean, and what do we do? There's a couple things in there. The book says I have to be convinced of a few things. The first thing I have to be convinced of is the ABCs, which is really basically step 1 and step 2. And I think those are the only problems we ever have with step 3 is step 1 and step 2. Once you really in your innermost self get that, I mean, it's like the decision is like comes from a Latin word, scissore, meaning to cut, like in scissors and incision. When you make the decision, you've got step 1 and step 2, you've really just cut away all the alternatives. There's nothing left. There's either a God or I'm either a God that can solve my problems or I'm screwed here. Isn't that odd that a guy like me who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous as an atheist came here being with a feeling that if there was a God, I was in a lot of trouble because I had a vision of a judgmental God. And yet, and eventually alcoholism has its way with you and you get to a point where if there's not a God, I'm in a lot of trouble. And that became very, very real to me. And Chuck Chamberlain used to say that there was one problem and it contained all problems. It was conscious and unconscious separation between me and you and me and God and maybe me and life itself. I've always felt distant. I've always had that state of anxious apartness that Wilson talks about, the feeling that's all of you and then there's me. There's life and then there's me. There's God and then there's me. That separation. And alcoholism is a lonely business. And I understand when he said that, I understood it because I've always felt secretly apart from and never connected to. I drank alcohol for unity, because in the early days of drinking, it was spectacular. It connected me to life. I could feel like I was a part of life. I was a part of you. I was connected to you. I could come out and play. It was spectacular. And then as the light of alcohol started to fade and it stopped doing that thing for me and only did the hideous things to me, the book says we know a loneliness such as few do. We'll be at the jumping off place and we'll wish for the end. And that's that jumping off place is where I was in 1978 when I tried to take my own life. And off of that, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I went from the guy who knew everything. I was an I know guy. You know, when I was a kid, my parents, because I was difficult at home, they took me to a psychologist to be tested to see if I, in those days you could go to school a year early if you tested high enough. And I had this 148 IQ, and they started telling me you're so wonderful. And now that we know that, I don't have to do anything. I mean, we know I'm smart and you're stupid, so just let's leave it at that. And and I always felt apart from. And you know something? The later years of my alcoholism, I felt different and separate and apart from because I was worse than everybody else. And I got to tell you, I don't think there's any difference spiritually between being separate because you're smarter than everybody or being separate because you're more stained and decrepit than everybody. I'm still separate. And I'm in the separation. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys started hitting me with this page 60 through 63. My first sponsor was a fanatic with that. He had me read it over and over and over again. And it's funny, I could read this stuff, and it is me, but I can't see that it is me. You know, and boy, it is me. It says selfishness and self-centeredness that we think is the root of our troubles. It is the source of the separation. And I can't see that. I can't see that the reason I feel so lonely and apart from you is I got too much of me between me and you. I'm too judgmental. I'm too opinionated. I'm too full of me and my little plans and designs. I can't see that until a day came where I could, the veil, the pain and frustration in my life sober lifted the veil. And it was one of those rough, rough days. And everything was wrong. It was one of those days where just everybody just annoyed me. It's like the whole world got up 2 hours before I did and had a meeting about, let's get Bob. You know what I mean? It felt like that. You know what I mean? It kind of felt like that. Everybody's screwing with me all day long, man. And I'm just get angst up, more and more uptight. And just like I felt like I was going to have a nervous breakdown. And the end of that day, after coming out of an AA meeting that I was the secretary of, and I had a new guy there, and he was going to hear the message of AA, and I'd set it up. I got the right readings. I got the right chairman and co-chairman. This guy's going to hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, eventually get his year and mention my name, and it was going to be great. And the meeting just went south on me. Oh, my God. It became a bickering meeting, and people fighting over crap, and I went home, and I feel like I've had it. I can't take anymore. I call my sponsor up, and he says, read page 60 through 63. And I get to the bottom of page 60, and the veil, the pain lifted the veil. And I, for the first time in my life, I could see something that had always been there. But I could, as Polly quoted Chucky, we can only see what you can see when you can see it. And all of a sudden, I can see that I'm like the actor who wants to run the whole show. I could see that I'm forever arranging the lights, the scenery, the ballet, the people in traffic, the people in the grocery store, the people in the meeting, what they're sharing in my own way. If only my arrangements would stay put, if only people would do as I wished. And it's funny, I could see you were doing that because there's some real control freaks in AA. But I could be doing the exact same behavior, and I'm not trying to run the show because I'm doing it the right way. This is not ego. This is just truth. This is just goodness. And so I started to see myself in this part of the book, and then all of a sudden, a lot of this stuff started making sense to me. I started understanding that selfishness, self-centeredness, this hyper self-consciousness, this over-exaggerated staring at my own feelings and thoughts and judgments and judging you when you don't agree with me and my opinion-generating mind and on and on and on, how it was just, it was destroying me. I had a guy say to me fairly early in sobriety something, and I got it, which is surprising because I guess I just had enough of me kicked out of me in the beginning that I could hear some stuff. And this guy said to me, he told me, he said, you need to take step three. And I told him, I said, I can't because I don't believe in God. And I was praying that you guys had me in the process of coming to believe that those sustained actions that eventually bring me around and have an experience. But I still didn't believe in God yet. I hadn't, the miracles haven't overwhelmed me yet. The coincidences haven't overwhelmed me yet. And I said to Joe, I said, I can't, I don't believe in God. And he said, you don't have to believe in God. And he said, listen, kid, turn your will and your life over to this chair. I make you a promise. I'll make you a promise if you do that, that everything's going to be fine. And I thought, all right. I turn my will, my life over the chair. And Joe says, the miracle is your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot. You know what's so amazing looking back is that I got that. I didn't get offended. I didn't argue with it. I just, inside myself, I just thought, yeah, that'd be right. Yeah. Because I got it. I was starting to wake up a little bit, just a little bit, to the truth about me and my life. And I got, not at about a year sober, I got down on my knees with another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said that third prayer, thinking that I knew what I was doing, because the book says we thought well, and I thought I knew what I was doing. I got to tell you, honest to God, I don't even think I understood the words of the prayer, really. And I took that third step prayer, and my life went chaotic for about 10 months. There were times in there I felt like I was going to have a nervous breakdown. I mean, stuff was being ripped out of my life. And the problem is not what's going on. The problem is God's doing exactly what I ask him to do in the third step prayer. When I said, for you to build with me and do with me as you will. And God got to work. And I was like an old burnout building. Somebody's trying to rehab. You got to tear a lot of crap out in order to make room for new stuff. Here's the problem. God never asked for my approval of the plans. And that's what's making my head want to blow up. And I'm so full of fear and anxiety because it's like out of control. Well, that's what I said in the third step prayer. I'm really saying to God, look what I've done with my life. It's horrible, and it's horrible on my best intentions. You know, I've been a victim of this delusion my whole life. Even it creeps up on me sometimes today, little bits of it. This delusion I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world by managing well. And I started to wake up to the fact of what my life looks like in my hands. And there was a song written by Kris Kristofferson, that was made famous by Janis, and the song was Bobby McGee, and there's a line in there that says, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. When you really get what your life is like in your hands with good intentions, sober a while, going to meetings, and you start to see what's happening, you're at a place where you got nothing left to lose. There's either something else I can turn this over to, or I'm kind of screwed, you know. But I don't trust God. I don't trust him. But I don't trust anything. You know, trust for me was like an atrophied muscle that never been used. And I got forced. Polly quoted that part of the book where you had to fearlessly face the proposition. Crushed. Had to fearlessly face the proposition, God's either everything or he's nothing, and we get there. I think it's unavoidable. I had a guy, a sponsor, come up to me, and he had this horrible look on his face of terror, and he says, quietly, he says, do you think it's possible to lose your mind and have a nervous breakdown sober? And I I said, I was being a wise guy. I said, not only do I think it's possible, I think it's necessary. Right? Well, I mean, how do you get ready to give up? How do you get ready to surrender if it's working for you? If you're managing your life is working for you, why would you ever do that? See, I wouldn't. You know, I wouldn't be. I'd be doing less AA, more Anthony Robbins, I think, or something. I'd be trying to maneuver. I'd be trying to manage. I'd be trying to fix stuff. I'd be resting happiness and satisfaction out of this world. And then probably charging money to show other people how to do it. Because that's the selfish guy I am. And so I took that third step prayer. My life fell apart. And in hindsight, and I love Bob says this all the time, that I can see really good backwards, not so good forward. And that's so true. But in hindsight, and a lot of my trusting in God has been developed in hindsight when I see his hand in my life, that everything, absolutely, with no exception, everything that was changed and transformed and torn out of my life in those days was just absolutely necessary. Absolutely, it had to go. Well, I get to this, I say the third step prayer close to a year sober, and I started having this difficulty because I don't understand what's going on. You know, I incorporated the third step prayer into my morning routine. And I would get up in the morning, I'd roll out of bed, I'd get on my knees, I had said some other prayers, and then I would say the third step prayer. And I would offer my self to God. I would say, here for today. And I injected the word today. I want you to build with me, and I offer myself to you today for you to build with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of this bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away these difficulties, that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help. Today, may I do your will always. And I started saying that prayer. And then I would get up off my knees, and I would be getting ready to go to work, and I would start having conversations in my head with people that aren't in the room. Right? And it's all generated by fear, anxiety. I would, you know, those conversations, my boss is probably going to ask me about that. Well, I'll tell him this, and he'll tell me that, and I'll say this, and he'll say that, and I'll say this, and that'll get me a raise, probably. I think, you know, I mean, it's all me stuff. It's all me. I'm not having conversations in my head for your benefit. It's all for me, and to protect me and defend me. And I'm blocked. And I had a conversation with a guy, Ted Davis, who died with a lot of years of sobriety. And Ted, I told Ted, I said, I don't know what's going on. I get up and I pray and I have all this anxiety. And he said, well, you pray, but do you trust God? And and we were talking about faith. I had faith, but he said, do you trust God? And I'm not sure what he means. And he told me this story. He said, if you went to a circus and you sat in the audience and you watched a tight wire act and you watched a professional tightrope walker come out to the edge of the wire on the platform and he's pushing a wheelbarrow, I said, it'd be very easy to have all the faith in the world. This guy can walk across that tight wire pushing that wheelbarrow. You'd say to yourself, I bet you he's done it 1,000 times. He's a professional, absolute faith, he can do it. But if you really trusted, you'd sit in the wheelbarrow and let him walk you across. And when he said that, I got this horrible sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach. Because I know what he wants me to do. He wants me to become that vulnerable and that undefended and that helpless. And to trust God at that level. And I understand what he's saying. I agree with it. I like talking about it. I like going to book studies where we read about it. I like going out to coffee with people and pontificating about the wheelbarrow and the joys of the wheelbarrow. Right? I just ain't getting in the damn wheelbarrow. You know what I'm saying? Because I'm afraid. I I've been listening to this for too long. And I've been trusting God as nothing, really. I mean, a little bit of stuff. I have a little track record with him, but not much. And as time goes on, I think the battle that I fight here is the battle against me to get in that wheelbarrow and to trust God. And I hate to even say this because it's if you're new, if I was new and I heard this, I don't know. I think I'd run screaming out of the room. But I think truly, I think it took me close to 30 years of trying to practice this stuff before I really started to trust God. Now, that doesn't mean I wasn't doing well in those first couple decades, and my life was progressing in all areas, and it was really good. But what's evidentiary is what happens to me when I'm afraid. What do I turn to for my source? Do I turn to money? Do I turn to friends? Do I turn to God? And I think the anxiety still plagued me with like a pack of rabid dogs. And then I noticed something. I don't even know when it happened. I noticed that I started feeling more comfortable even in situations that would have one time had me running around like Chicken Little with the skies falling, and I was okay. And I guess that maybe what happens and happened to me, and some people it happens quicker than it took me, is you develop a track record that you can rely on with God. You know, it just happens. It's the first 5 or 10 times God bails me out of a situation, I'm still skeptical. It could have been me in there, really. I'm not sure, you know, right? I mean, it could have just been happenstance. It could have been coincidences. But, you know, eventually it's like overwhelming. And I start to know something. I mean, know something. And anything that means anything here is experiential, and it's in the pit of my stomach. I started to really, truly know that God loves me and he's there for me. And that's not that I can't sabotage my own life. I can. But if I can take my hands off the wheel and be willing to go make amends, God will right things in my life. He always has. He always has, without fail. You send a CSI team into my life when it's in disaster, you're only going to find my DNA. You're not going to find nobody. You're not going to find God's. You're not going to find nobody else. It's me. It's me. And I get that. Well, so I'm saying this third step prayer every morning. I'm getting up off my knees and I'm reaping the anxiety of playing God. And I don't even know that, but I am. That's what I'm doing. My life is still in my care. And when your life is in your care, oh, there's a lot of stuff to worry about. Oh, man. There's a world out there full of people and they're all thinking something. You don't know what it is, but you suspect it's about you. You know what I mean? There's just the potential for it. I remember some person with a year sober came into our home group one night, and before the meeting started, I said, "How you doing?" And she looked at me and she goes, "It's too big." Oh, I knew. I wanted to hug her. I knew exactly what she meant. It's too big. When it's in my hands, it's too big. No wonder I intermittently feel like I'm having a nervous breakdown. I mean, because it's too big. I need God, and yet I'm blocked from God. And that's what was happening. And on the bottom of page 63, right after the third step prayer, it describes me with several years of sobriety. It says, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Though our decision, step 3, was a vital and crucial step, and it is, but it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. I know what that feels like, that you're sober and you're stuck. And you're stuck. And you can't. You want to be different. You want to be better. You want to be freer, and you can't. I get that. Because when I would get down on my knees and I'd say the third step prayer, I don't know that I could have been any more genuine. There were times when I would say it and I really wanted God to have my life. I wanted to get it out of the hands of the idiot, but I can't let go of it. And it's because I never went through the rest of the steps. But I don't know that. Because I had done it a year sober, a little over a year sober. I did a 40-page inventory that was really honest. I mean, I held nothing back. All the deep, slimy, dark, shameful secrets were all on there. And then I was suffering from alcoholism more so as time went on. And I, at 3 years sober, I did the one out of the 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, which was the popular book about the steps in the late 70s, early 80s. And I answered the 30-some questions on chapter 4 and wrote a good part of a page on each of the seven deadly sins. And it was a great and a very interesting exercise. But it really didn't change this separation. In that period of time, someone at one of the clubs accused me of having my sense of humor surgically removed. I mean, because when you're in the bondage of self, you're serious, self-righteous, self-grandizing, self-justifying, self, right? And I'm all of that. And I can't stop being that way. I wanna, but the wanna is not enough. When the book says lack of power is my dilemma, boy, they got something there. The most sincere desire to become different does not make me different. And I had to go, I finally, at about 4 years sober, by this time, I had actually taken a guy, a sponsor, through the fourth step in the book. I'd listened, it's somewhere I don't remember exactly when, but I think it was late 1980 or maybe early 81, I heard my first set of Joe and Charlie tapes that they came back from the International, or Wesley Parrish, who changed. Wesley Parrish was one of the great unsung heroes of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know people in Australia, I met this guy, Ronnie Carr, told me about how Wesley came to Australia and changed AA there by introducing people to the book. Wesley was the guy who put out the 100 sets of cassettes on Joe and Charlie and spread them all over the world. And within 2 years, Joe and Charlie was everywhere. And I got one of those set of those cassettes and I listened to it. It changed my life. Because I'm a member of a big book group. I'm a member of a big book group. We prided ourselves as being a big book group. I listen to Joe and Charlie and I'm thinking, what book are they talking about? I mean, I was hearing stuff. There was a lot. There was past delegates in my home group. There was some old timers in my home. Nobody talked about this stuff. And I sat down and I did my first legitimate fourth step. Now, I've done quite a few since then. And I don't argue, sometimes when I say that people want to come up to me and tell me, well, you never do the first 9 steps again. You live in 10, 11, and 12. Well, good for you. I don't argue with that. I think in theory, in an ideal world, what you're saying is absolutely right. But when Wilson says no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles, boy, he's talking about me. I don't even get close. I leak. I leak, man. And I don't even know I'm leaking. And it's just little incremental judgments and anxieties that I just sort of, they don't bother me because I'm sober a long time. You know what I mean? You just kind of sweep them under the rug, you know, and next thing you know, everybody on the horizon is stupid. You know what I mean? It just happens like that. It's crazy. And I start to be full of anxiety again and judgments and those are the and I'll and that pushed enough into that zone, I'm very capable of acting out on all kinds of insane behavior that has to do with self-gratification, because when I'm full of me, I need a distraction. And I get sick. And I get sick, and it's time to go back and clean house again. But the first one was transformational for me. And, you know, I started doing the resentment inventory, and it asked me to do 6 things in the book. Now, 4 of those are implied writing, but I think the ones that aren't writing are the most important, the ones that changed my life. And, you know, the book says we listed people, institutions, and principles. So I'm putting who. And, you know, I run into guys all the time. You say, I want you to make a resentment list. And they say the craziest things. They're like, oh, well, I don't have any resentments. Really? Well, I think my name's going to be on that list before this conversation's over. Right. Because I have to, it's my job if I'm sponsoring you to try to just get that delusion out of the way. You don't have any resentments. Okay, listen. Why don't we do something different? Let's make a list of the stupid people. And everybody gets a look on their face like, oh yeah, that's a long list. Oh yeah, I got that. Or let's make a list of people you feel smugly superior to. Let's make a list of the wrong people that owe you and the universe an amends. We're bound to make a long list. If you're new and you haven't done this, we could do it kind of for you. Just mother, father, ex before ex, boss, ex-boss, other boss, children, and everyone else you've ever known, pretty much. And when I'm 4 years sober and I'm doing this, I've been in AA going to 15 meetings a week for 4 years, so my list is primarily people in AA. I mean, you know, right? Well, because I have a refined noticer, and I have a sick perception. I don't look at people to see the good in them. Who cares? I like to see the things that are wrong with people. You know what I mean? That's my perception. It's hideous, it's childish, and it's egocentric, but that's the way I look at life. So I got all these people in AA on my list, and my mother and father and all that stuff too, but God, it was so horrible. And then I want to do the causes. And one of the things I did, and I later realized that could have been better, is I wrote too much on column number 2. Because the book is talking about bullet points. And I don't like bullet points because they really don't get into why this person needs to be killed. I mean, no, I want to write paragraphs, you know. I want to write it out to the point where I'd sit down. I might sit down with Bob and start to tell him about it. And he'd go, they did that to you. I'm getting the boys together. You know what I mean? I wish there was a way to make resentments contagious. I want you to hate who I hate the way I hate who I hate. Right? And if you don't hate who I hate you. You know, you're stupid, right? You're stupid. Right? Do you ever have somebody you have a resentment towards and one of your best friends comes up and tells you how much they like that person? Well, he's not my best friend anymore. Oh, man. Oh. Isn't that just so pathetic and childish? Well, I'll tell you, there have been times when it's been hard being me. So the second thing I do is the bullet points, just the facts, not the story about what happened, but what happened. And then what aspects of self had been hurt. Book uses 5 terms: hurt, threatened, interfered with, injured, affected. And, you know, it's pride. Pride's a big one. You know, pride is a big one. There are people who will commit suicide over losing face, right? Pride's a big one. Sex. I could take you to meetings in penitentiaries where guys are doing long time in prison because they killed somebody, and it wasn't even the right guy. They killed somebody they thought had slept with their girlfriend or wife. Pride, pocketbook, sex, ambitions, my way. Oh, don't get in the way of my way. The alcoholic ego hates to be thwarted. It hates it. And I start putting all this on paper, and then the book spends a whole page trying to sell me something. The deadliness of this. And Bob, this stuff's killing you. It's poison. It's cutting you off from the sunlight of the spirit. You're going to die, Bob. You got to be willing to give this up. Are you? And then it just takes me to a place. It says, if you buy all that, then it says we were prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle. And was I? And I was. I was like the rat. I don't want any more cheese. I just want out of this trap. And I don't need to be right anymore. I would rather be free. Some people, I've listened to Fifth Steps, and they get to that point, and they will not change their mind, and they will not even consider the possibility that they're wrong about their father or their mother or their ex. They won't even consider the possibility. And that is, each of us is right. We have the right to stay sick. We have the right to remain hostage. You don't have to change your mind. And no, God's not going to punish you. We're not punished for our sins. We're punished by them. And you can stay as miserable as you want. But I thank God I was at a point where I was willing to look at these from an entirely different angle and just get off the prosecutor's bench and get up and walk across the courtroom and now sit on the defense table and start thinking about this situation between me and my dad and me and my bosses and me and my exes and me and my mom, and looking at it from their eyes. And the book kind of walks us through that after it hammers me with a difficult truth. It says that you can't wish these things away any more than alcohol, and you can't. I remember in my 11th year of sobriety, I was going through a very, very painful patch of road. It was very difficult. My wife and 2-year-old daughter, and I got a divorce. Didn't even know why I was getting the divorce until the day after the divorce, when I realized that my wife and 2-year-old daughter moved in with my sponsee best friend. And I'm insane. And people in AA say crazy things to you when you're nuts. They'll say things like, "Well, just don't think about it." Yeah. I had one guy say, do you believe in God? I said, yeah, I do. And he said, well, then it shouldn't be a problem. He almost had a problem because I was going to punch him. You can't wish these away. And believe me, truly, believe me, I knew it was killing me. And I wanted to be free of it. But the wanting is not the doing. And so I what happens is I start to get to that. I start to get to the bottom of the page, and I realize that all the wishful thinking in the world doesn't make the resentments go away. It just deludes me, and I'll build an ulcer over those things because they haven't really gone away. I've just pushed them down. And so what do you do? And the book says, this was our course. And this next two lines, it's two different realizations. And when I could do these, this changed my life. And I really, truly, I've never been quite the same since. The first realization is easy. It says we realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Yes, they are. And they're stupid, too. Where's Dr. Kevorkian now that we need him? Let's put him out of their misery. See, my ego loves that. It loves the smug superiority of a well person looking down on a pathetic, sick person. Now, if that was all it said, I'd just reinforce the resentment, reinforce the separation, reinforce the judgment, reinforce the blockage. But then it says, if once you make that realization that they're sick, it starts walking me through something. It says, though you did not like their symptoms, did you, Bob? What symptoms? column number two, the bullet points. There, I think it was Billy Graham that said, "Love the sinner, hate the sin." And what did they start realizing? I don't hate you. I don't resent you. I resent what you did. It hurt me, but I don't resent you. Really, because if you wouldn't have done what you did, you wouldn't even been on the list, right? I don't resent you. I resent your actions. And you're implying that these are the actions of a sick person. So I don't like their symptoms. So you're telling me that the things in column number two are symptomatic of a spiritual illness? Well, got to ask myself the right questions here. I hurt a lot of people. I had a terrible eight-step list. Was there anyone on that list that I hurt maliciously and consciously that I set out to hurt them? Or did I hurt them because I'm so full of myself and self-centered fear and vacancy and I'm driven by all this stuff and I step on the toes of people? Yeah, I never intended to hurt my mother and father. I just devastated them. Never meant to, but I hurt them. And I hurt them because I was sick. And those are my symptoms. What I did to them was the symptoms of my sickness. And not only didn't I like their symptoms, I didn't like the way these symptoms disturbed me. And then here's the kicker. I almost, this would have been easy to miss, but thank God I had taken a guy through this. And it's funny, I learned how to do a fourth step by taking a guy through a fourth step. It's a different perspective when you're doing it to help someone else. It's a funny thing. I don't think I could. I saw stuff in helping this guy do it. I don't think I could have sat down and tried to do it for me and would have seen it. And then it says, even though I don't like the symptoms, column two, and the way these disturb me, column three, that I had to realize how this person was like me, spiritually sick. So this is, it's asking me to come from a place of honesty and humility that I don't like to come from. Because what they're really asking me to do is to get honest enough to see myself in this person. Honest enough to come off the high horse of judgment where I'm playing God and just come right down and see myself in you. To see how if maybe I haven't done anything as severe or grievous as you've done. But it's not because I'm better than you. Maybe I didn't have the terrible childhood you had. Because hurt people will hurt people. Maybe I just never had the right combination of whiskey and fear that drove me. But can I understand? Can I see the truth that if I had everything going on in me that was going on in you, that I could have easily done to you what you did to me? I am not superior. You are me. You're me on a bad day, maybe, but you're me. And when you start to see yourself and really put yourself in another person's shoes, it's funny. The resentment starts to fade away. It's real true forgiveness. And it's I'm giving for them what I would hope you would give for me if the tables were turned. I'm giving what I wanted, what I so need to receive. See, I want to receive your understanding. I want to receive your forgiveness. I want to receive your love, but I'm not willing to give it. And you can't receive it till you give it. That's the problem. I had it backwards all my life. I had it backwards. My spiritual path, my imagined spiritual path is me and God are going to be really good and you're still going to all be jerks, right? The problem is my relationship with God is directly connected to my relationship with you. As I think what Einstein said was true, that the big illusion of mankind, there's more than one of us here. The Hindus talk, this transfers right into the Buddhism when they talked about their vision of creation, that God existed unto himself. They call it Maya, the great hallucination, the great illusion. And he broke himself into an infinite number of parts and gave all the parts amnesia. And the trick is which parts are going to wake up to the truth that they're not separate and they are one with God, not separate from God. And it's almost identical to the stuff that Chamberlain talks about and what it talks about on page 55 in the big book. And as I started to see myself in you, and really, I mean really, I started to have something for some of you that I never had before. Selfish people don't have this. I started to have compassion and understanding. Compassion comes from Latin, cum meaning with, and passio pain, is that I start to sit with your pain. I get it. I get it. I get you're me. You're me. I could have done. Maybe I did. Sometimes I discovered that I not only had done, I not only could I have done what you did, I did it. And sometimes I did it worse. And what started to amaze me in this world that seemed to be so unfair and so hostile, I started waking up to a different truth. That people were a lot more forgiving and kinder with me than I would have been with them if the tables were turned. It's hard to admit. It was hard to admit that the people I judged so harshly, that I actually had a higher level of selfishness than they did. That I wasn't as kind with them as they were with me. And, you know, one of the things that Harry Thibault talks about is that we must have the ego reduction at depth. And my problem with God is I got too much of me in the way. And when I did this fourth step and I went back through all of this and I did the prayer and finally the last part where you're putting out of your mind the wrongs others have done, disregard them entirely. So now I'm looking dead on at my actions and I can't hide them in the shadow of what you've done wrong. And as I did that, it's like every time I dismantled one of my judgments like that, I started looking at my parents like that, and I started looking at my selfishness against the backdrop of what if they were perfect? Now, what kind of a son was I? And I started not only seeing how wrong I was, every time I did, it was like notching down this ego, just like, wrong, Bob. Wrong again, Bob. Wrong again, Bob. Wrong again, Bob. Wrong again, stupid Bob. Wrong. No, it's like in The Wizard of Oz. I'm melting, you know. It's like, I came out of the fifth step. I didn't feel a nearness to my Creator so much. You know what? I felt small. I felt something that I had felt in the detox. That I think is really, I didn't understand it. I think I get it a little bit better now. I felt like I really don't know anything. Ego reduction at depth. Now, don't worry, the ego came back. It comes back armed with the fourth step. It comes back, you know, with exceptions. It's just horrible. It's horrible. But it was the beginning. And then the fear inventory, I never imagined how driven I was by fear. I can't, it's hard for me to identify fear because it is the water I swim in. It is the driving force in my life. And my sex inventory was, I almost wanted to enhance it and make shit up, you know. I was a drunk. I didn't have. I mean, my first sex inventory was pathetic. I made up for it later, but it was kind of pathetic. But what became very clear to me is how scared I was, and how often I was dishonest because I'd misrepresent myself because I'm afraid that, as is, you wouldn't love me. Because I don't. And how I was dishonest, and how I was afraid, and how I was driven, and how I was me first. You know, with my fiance, friends of mine that have known me for a lot of years, they say, we've never seen you like this. I wish I could tell you. I wish I could take credit for that. I don't know. I don't know how that's happened. I don't know. I've never been this other-centered. I just have never been there before. And it's pretty cool. I get scared sometimes. I'm afraid it'll fade, but it hasn't. And I keep praying for it, and I keep trying to take the actions of love and the actions of kindness and those things, and I'm pretty good so far. It's been good. I've been the best, and not perfect by any means, but I have been the best version of Bob. I'm the best version of Bob today than I've ever been. And I still have a ways to go, but I am the best version. And one of the benchmarks for me on how I'm doing spiritually is when I go to my home group, when I'm in traffic, when I'm out in the world, how you look to me is a reflection of me. Because when I'm in a really good space, I go to my home group, man, I just love the people there. And they're not perfect. I mean, at all. But I see bits and pieces of my... I love them for their imperfections, almost. But when I'm full of myself, I start picking and noticing. And I've been in a really good... I love my home group lately. I have great relationships with my sponsees. Sometimes I'm a little abrupt. I just had a guy I sponsor. He's sober a long time, and if they give you permission to sponsor him, sometimes you have to be direct, even though it might hurt their feelings. And I had to say to this guy recently, I said, "Listen," he said, "Well, you seem a little distant." I said, "Well, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be, but you're a predator." He goes, "What do you mean I'm a predator?" I said, "You're a sexual predator." He says, "No, I'm not." I said, "Listen, I can name 10 newcomer girls you've slept with in less than a year. This is not mistakes. This is habitual." And he looks at me and he goes, "Well, I have a reason for each one. I mean, I know you do. I know you do. I know you do." But... And I say, "Listen, I'm not mad at you. I love you, and I'd like you to be a better version of yourself. Because I know something. Because every time I've acted out with self, I never feel that good about myself." And he looked at me and he said, he got honest. He says, "You know something, I don't really feel very good about myself either." I said, "I don't know." Then he told me that the 10 was a short number. Right. And people have said those kind of things to me, and they say it because they love me. My sponsor has said things to me that have been so abrupt at times, took my breath away. Because when I look at my life sometimes, I look at through filters of justification and rationalization and explanation, and I'm defended. And I need someone in my life that's going to say, "Listen, that ain't the way you think it is. You're delusional." And say it with love. They say the truth will set you free. Yeah, it can ruin your day first, though. I tell you, it's... And I don't like hearing stuff like that any more than anybody else does. But I have a couple people I let into my life, and they love me enough, they tell me those kind of things. Because I can't always see it. And it's not out of maliciousness. It's ego is the most defended mechanism on the planet. It's so defended. And the defense is unrecognized by the person that's in the middle of it. And I don't recognize it. And when I'm defended, I'm separate from God. You cannot be surrendered and defended at the same time. They're mutually exclusive positions. So for me to be closer to God, I have to be closer to you, and I have to be freer and undefended. Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life what whiskey used to do. I drank whiskey for one reason, truly, one reason. I drank it for the feeling of freedom. I drank it because I could come out and play and I could be right here with you. And Alcoholics Anonymous, it contingent on how much I'm doing some of this stuff, will create the same results. I like being free. There's only one freedom, and it contains all freedoms, and that's the freedom from the bondage of self. Thanks for listening.